Hey everybody, welcome back to Route 25, brought to you by Fox Valley Magazine and When and How Communications. Today we're speaking with Mario Spina, who is the CEO of the Pride Group of Stores. The stores are convenience stores slash gas stations slash restaurants slash wine and liquor. You'll understand when we talk to him. And we're also going to talk about the newest thing, a brewery and tap room that has been created by the Pride stores. It's called 93 Octane, and we'll get into all of it. But it's we thought it would be pretty neat to talk about craft beer in the context of a convenience store and gas stations. So anyway, here's Mario. I would guess that by this point, pretty much everybody in the Fox Valley has seen at least and probably purchased something from one of your stores.
Yeah, certainly.
So maybe tell us a little bit about the story behind the Pride stores. It started with your father, Peter, right?
Yeah, my father, Peter, started the Pride stores. Well, he was self-employed in a couple of different avenues. He started our main distribution company, which is called Parent Petroleum, which is the main company, which is based in St. Charles as well. We're on our 39th year this year. Yeah, so that started. And then we also have direct applications as well. Like you were saying, we have 15 total. You know, my dad, when he started building stores that we ran direct, he would always call them the pride of whatever city was in. So we had like the Pride of Carroll Stream, we had the Pride of Geneva. You know, back then we had Pride of Villa Park, and he wanted to call them the Pride so that we would stress that not only are we a part of the community, but we take pride in being in this community and we take pride in our operations. So he would always call them the Pride, and we kind of took it to a different level, created the logo, and then just started calling them the Pride and tried to elevate his original kind of thoughts or visions of us operating stores direct. Yeah, I remember my dad was self-employed for a while. I came on board after college, didn't think it was for me. So I went back, I got my MBA, and then my father had some health issues. So after my MBA, I came back to help him out. I'm like, yeah, I'll help you out for a little bit. And then, you know, God, I've been here now 20 years. I don't even know.
Yeah. Right. You still got one foot out the door, right?
Yeah, exactly right.
That's funny. You know, it's, I was speaking with Amy Morton recently. She's the daughter of Arnie Morton, Morton Steakhouses, right? Oh, okay. And Amy is a restaurateur herself. And I asked her, I said, what was it like getting into the same business as kind of a legendary father, a really successful father in the same business? I mean, is that a plus or a minus? Matt, what do you think about that? I mean, is it good? Is there a challenge to it? I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, the biggest challenge I had with my father being in the business, and when he graduated, he actually went to, it's kind of funny. He graduated college from Loyola, but he originally started off at DePaul, and he actually had a basketball scholarship. He played under Ray Meyer. And then I guess he said after his freshman year, a lot of the guys returned from the war and they were a lot bigger than him. And then Ray Meyer had a conversation with him saying, "Hey, Petey, I don't think I can keep your scholarship anymore. We got some other guys on the bench that are coming back." But when he went to Loyola, and then he actually got a master's at Loyola as well. And he worked for Texaco. He was one of four heads of the United States, like different regions for Texaco. So he was in the business for a very long time. And, I didn't mind my dad being part of the business. I think people have a misconstrued perception that if your father's the boss, it's easier, and it's actually not. It's usually a lot harder because people expect more from you. My opinion. The big thing that was for me and my dad was just the stress on our relationship, because I was always really close to my dad. And when we started working with each other every day, we had a lot of two somewhat hot-headed Italians going at it every day. It created a little bit of a stress on our relationship personally. And that's the only thing that was really difficult for us in having a family business. But besides that, my dad did a lot of great things, and I love him. And, I know he's up in heaven looking down at me saying, like, what the hell are you doing? You just opened a restaurant. You just did this. He's like, are you freaking nuts? No one's doing that up above. But overall, it was great working with my dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's had a strenuous moments, don't get me wrong, but overall, it's great.
No doubt. I'm trying to imagine working with my father. I love my father dearly. Same thing, with you. I can't imagine working with him. I'm half Italian as well. So, and I get that from him. So yeah, it would be ugly. Anyway. Okay. You mentioned the restaurants. Really interesting concept. I mean, you've got three basically food concepts, quick service food concepts that you've sort of developed in house, sort of from the ground up. I mean, before we get to talking about them, was that in response to a lot of the chain stations getting QSRs like McDonald's and Subway and all that stuff in the same roof?
That was going on pretty heavy. I mean, Subway, Dunkin' Donuts was going in all these locations, and we did a large purchase with BP, it's been over 10 years now, where we purchased 70 of their assets, or 90, I'm sorry, of their assets. And then what I mean by assets, it means property, stations that they ran direct. Also, like I said, we have Parent Petroleum, which is the main company that we supply over 400 stations in the Chicagoland market that, majority of them aren't ours. Obviously, we only have 15. And when we did that, we bought some of the locations. We were planning on keeping some of their stores and turn them into private stores and run them direct. And these stores, the ones that my dad built, the five that we ran direct previous to this, I mean, he didn't build huge convenience stores back then. You didn't really need it. I mean, he just, did the minimal size store, and there's no room for food service or anything else of that nature. And then we got these big stores from BP that are like 4,000, 5,000 square feet that had kitchen areas. And we're like, holy crap, what are we going to do with this stuff? It's a lot of space. And, we always try to do things. We call ourselves the price stores. Our slogan is not your typical convenience stores. So we try to do things that are different than other people. I mean, yeah, we could have done Dunkin' Donuts or Subway or done something like that, and probably gotten some decent rental out of it and been fine. But, we'd rather do something that kind of differentiates us from other operators in the area. And that's why, I had a good friend of mine that was wrapping up culinary school, and we sat down and I'm like, listen, I want to do something a little different, And he came up with the original menu for Urban Counter, which we have in St. Charles. And, we have one in Aurora as well. And, we do half pound hand pressed hamburgers. Our my favorite burger, I got a couple of favorite ones, I guess, but my favorite one is the blue cheeseburger. We do a bacon jam spread that we make in house, arugula, it's on a potato bun. Breakfast sandwiches are all hand cracked eggs made to order. Our salads are made to order as well. They're fresh and, as many local ingredients as we can. And I just wanted something that could rival any other quick service restaurant out there. Cause we're kind of like, if we're going to do anything, running gas stations, car washes, restaurants, whatever it may be, if we're not going to try and be just as good, if not better than anyone else out there, then I just don't want to do it. So, when we came up with the first concept of a counter, that's what we're trying to do, kind of like an American fare that'll appeal for everybody. They can eat it every day. I mean, our hot dogs are great. Our sandwiches are great. And so we came up with that first concept, and then we thought it would be cool if, we have locations all kind of around the burbs, and it'd be cool if somebody's driving and they see multiple Pride stores, that if they go to another Pride store right next to one, that we just don't have the same food offering at every single location. So that's why we started coming up with other concepts. We came up with Taco Urbano, which is, kind of like our Mexican fare. Everything's made to order. Guacamole, when you order it, they cut up two avocados right there in front of you. We make all of our salsas in-house. When you order chips, we fry them to order. It's really great food. And then we had another concept. We came up with the Pride Cafe, where we do paninis, we do crepes, we do espresso drinks. And we did those at locations that, we might need to get somebody in and out quickly, or we had limited parking, or we couldn't fit a hood, or we couldn't fit enough walk-in cooler space. And so that's why we kind of came up with multiple concepts, because we thought it'd be cool for customers when they're driving by and they see multiple stores, that they'd have a unique experience at almost every location you go to. And so, and we really wanted to do some high-end, affordable, made to order food that would really separate us from other gas station operators as well, that could rival, any other quick service restaurant out there, like I was saying. So that was kind of the goal originally, to set up the food. And Yeah, I mean, the food's great. If you haven't had it, you should definitely try it because it is really high-end, great food.
Yeah, I go to the Geneva location. I mean, it's relatively close to where I live. I that's my only gas station. And
I appreciate that. I'll pay the mortgage.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I am going in and tell them that I had this conversation. They're going to give me a discount, right? All right. So
I'm sure that'll happen. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's got the cafe, which is great. It's fantastic. I would really love to try the Urban Counter. Maybe I'll go over to St. Charles one of these days.
Oh, you should. I mean, I could definitely meet you there too. It's food's awesome. You're not going to get a better burger. I'm telling you, it's great.
I just think that's so cool because, you know, I worked in my misspent youth. I worked for McDonald's, well, a global supplier of McDonald's, for a while. And, they were, one of the things they did, was, the distribution, for the stores, both in the Midwest and then in most of Asia. And, people don't realize what a heavy lift what you did is. I mean, just in terms of the logistics of it, right? I mean, there's the menu and there's the, you've got to maintain the food, but just the distribution, stocking the stores, you know, making the right, build out, you know, so that you've got an efficient way of storing stuff, all of that. That's a heavy lift. That's impressive.
It wasn't easy. I mean, to make insult to injury or however else we want to view it, our office is in Warrenville. And we built a commissary in our warehouse / office for the retail operations. And we put a commissary in there. So we make all of our grab-and-go sandwiches that you see in the restaurants we all make in-house and we self-distribute. And then we also do in the commissary is we'll make like salad dressings because we make our salad dressings in-house for the Urban Counter and our jalapeno spread for the hot Urban Counter. Some of the bacon jam we'll make here, our salsas for the Taco Urbano we'll make in the commissary, and then we'll self-distribute it. It kind of adds another, you know, layer of complexity, but it also kind of helps efficiency-wise and consistency-wise to do some of those items in terms of the restaurant operations at the sites. It kind of helps a little bit on that aspect, but, you know, food service is not easy, especially the last few years with all the changes of, you know, no inside dining, can't find staff. It was tough for everybody the last few years, but the last few years have been really challenging on that front. But
yeah. Well, hats off to you though. I mean, it's a purely entrepreneurial thing. You just sort of thought it up and did it in the house. I really admire that. I really do. And now you're doing a brewery. I'm loving.
Like I think I'm just a glutton for punishment on something. Yeah, the brewery's been a blast, but I mean, whenever you get into a new business segment, there's always challenges you don't anticipate, but it's been a lot of fun and it's been great.
Yeah. So it's 93 octane, obviously a reference to the gas. So where did that come from?
Yeah, I get that question a lot.
I'll bet. I'll bet.
You're like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah, that's another way of putting it. Right.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah. So, you know, we always kind of joked around, like, how cool would it be to open a brewery? You know, like, how cool would it be to brew our own beer? You know, and it's kind of like more of a joke because, you know, of our 15 stores in Chicagoland, we got one in Indiana we just bought. We haven't converted it to Friday, we're remodeling it. But, you know, the places that we have a liquor license, you know, we have a really nice selection of craft beer. I mean, spend it on the store. And we try to focus heavy local as much as we can. And, you know, we just love craft beer. We always joked around about it, like, how cool would that be? How cool would that be, you know, brew our own beer? And then the conversation started to get a little more serious. And then, you know,
you literally talked yourself into it, right?
So we ended up having the space of the brewers that now is 1,000 square foot space. And we had that available. I'm like, you know, we got this space in St. Charles. I'm like, you know, that would be a pretty cool location for it. And originally what happened is we owned the station on the corner. And there was no real way to expand the building. It just, you know, it pumps on either side. There's tanks in the back. So we couldn't expand the building to like put in our food offering or to try and get a beer, wine, and spirit selection or anything of that nature. So we bought the lot next door. We built a 5,000 square foot building. We put Urban Counter on one side and we put our first liquor store. We call it the Pride Beer and Wine Plus Spirits in the middle. And we had cross access between the liquor store and the Urban Counter. And so we had that 1,000 square feet and we're like, you know, it would be really tight, but we might be able to do this. And my cousin, Chris, he's our head buyer for all the stores. And he also owns a distillery up north. And so, you know, it's not exact, but the equipment's very similar. You know, he was very familiar with the processes of getting distributors and dealing with the government regulations and things of that nature. And he was able to get some contacts for, you know, equipment providers. So we could start looking at equipment and everything else. And we started like laying out the space and started getting a little more serious. And you know, our biggest concern with opening the brewery is, you know, operationally, we think we could figure it out, but we just want to make really good beer. I mean, if we're going to do this, kind of like anything else we've done, you know, we want to make just as good a beer as anyone out there. So that was our real concern. It's like, all right, can we make really good beer in a limited space like this and still service our customers and everything else? And, you know, right now we're in a really good spot. I mean, we're making some really awesome beers right now. Our brewer's killing it. And it's been a lot of fun. We just, at the end of last year, we did an expansion for the brewery. We bumped out the building so we could double the size of the brew house, which our brewer loved. And then we added permanent outdoor seating in the front. So we originally only had like 20 seats inside the tap room. It was really small. And then when we did the addition and we added to the brew house, we were able to add a couple more tables on the inside. So we were able to go from like 20 seating capacity to having like 32 inside the tap room and 32 outside on the patio, and which was huge. And we put a garage door in between the tap room and the patio. And actually during the winter, we enclosed the patio with a vinyl panel so we could keep it open year round. And that was great because it allowed us just to service our customers more. But it's been a lot of fun. Like anything, it's a challenge. You know, when you get a new business segment and you go into it, there's always things that pop up that no matter how prepared you thought you were, it's going to be something that you have to address. But it's been awesome. We're making really good beer. I mean, we're in a real good spot right now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So is that beer just available at the tap house, or is it being distributed elsewhere?
No, it's distributed elsewhere. So we, you know, we obviously have it in the tap room. And the cool thing about the location that it's in is, like I said, it shares a building with our Pride Beer Wine Plus Spirits liquor store, and we also have Urban Counter. So the whole place is all cross access.
Yep.
So you can walk in and through the whole spot, and so you can obviously buy the beer there. But what's cool is, like, the liquor store has 400 wines on the wall. We go up to like $450 a bottle on wine. We have some really high end stuff in there, and we have a really great selection of spirits, and our bourbon selection is great. We do a lot of bourbon barrel picks with distillers like Traverse City, Journeyman, Old Elk, Knob Creek, and we got a lot of really cool stuff. And we also have 10 beers on, or 8 beers on draft in the liquor store of other people's beer that we just like. And we also have bourbon by the pour, so you can come in and try all the bourbon barrel picks we have. And you can also, like right now, we just opened up a 12-year Lot B Pappy for people to drink on site, you know. So it's been great. I'm getting distracted here. But
No, it's cool.
But we carry in every Pride store that has a liquor license, we carry our 9-octane beer. Some have more than others, depending on how well they sell craft beer in that store. But we're at about like 200 accounts now.
Wow.
Outside of Pride stores and outside of the tap room. And we obviously want to continue to grow. But you can get them kind of randomly around, you know.
Well, you must be doing something right. That's
we're popping up. It's not, you know, again, we want to keep growing. We want to get into more locations and keep growing the 93-octane brand. But we're in a decent amount of counts now. We're still pushing. We're still growing. So
yeah, that's awesome. Two other quick things. And they're industry things, because I'm talking to a gas guy and I need to know these things. Fuel prices. Where do you think those are going? I mean, obviously up, but how long do you think this is going to last?
I wish I had a magic, you know, ball to say that. I think they're going to be high for a while. There's a lot of other factors going on here besides just what's going on with Ukraine and Russia that have caused gas prices to go higher. So it's not that as soon as, God willing, that war will end soon, but it's not like when that war ends, all of a sudden prices are going to drop. I mean, people got to remember, prices were elevated, I think like $1.50 before this even occurred. And then it's gone up 75 cents since then. So
yeah,
it's, there's a lot of factors going into play that are causing these prices to be higher. It's a little bit of a frustrating thing because, we were, you know, energy independent a few years ago. And we were in a really good spot. And, you know, things, you know, with new administrations, the rules and regulations change. And it kind of put us in a position where, you know, if we would have continued down that path, prices would have increased because it's a, you know, it's a traded commodity, but it wouldn't have been as severe as it is now.
Yeah.
So I don't know how long it's going to take. I mean, if we can start opening up and drilling a little bit more, and you know, the issue that we have too is there's federal lands out there that, you know, they can, that they have, that oil companies have leases on. The problem is it's not cheap to excavate or to, you know, to get oil. It's not cheap. So an oil company is not going to sit there and spend the millions upon millions of dollars it is to start excavating or trying to pull oil out of the ground if they think that a month later the administration is going to say, like, you know, I don't want you to do it anymore, you're out of business.
Right.
So it's a very fluid time right now when it comes to prices. And for us, you know, when prices are higher, it's you know, there's a confusion out there. They think that gas stations are making a ton of money when prices are higher. When prices are higher, it's harder for us. You know, usually margins are thinner because nobody wants to continue to keep on raising their prices. Our credit card fees go through the roof because it's a percentage of sales. Right. When prices are higher, there's less disposable income for people to spend money on items inside the store. So our inside sales kind of get strained when this occurs as well.
Yep.
And also, you know, I say this all the time, like nobody looks forward to buying gas. I mean, nobody's like, oh, I gotta fill my tank today. This is awesome. You know, nobody ever says that.
No.
So, you know, and that's why, like, when we try to do all these other things, like good food and nice looking stores, bright, you know, blah, 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 to kind of help offset people having to fill the tanks.
Yep.
And when it's high like this, it makes it even harder. I mean, it's even, people regret even coming to your location even more when they know it's, the price is like double it was a couple of years ago. So
yeah.
I don't know when it's going to go down. I'm hoping soon. It's nothing that we look forward to, but
yeah, I think we're going to need a new administration for that, to be honest with you. But
I kind of think that as well, because right now it's this current administration, I mean, they came in and they were saying that it's a frustrating thing because I talk about this quite often. There is no more affordable, reliable, and abundant form of energy out there than oil.
Yeah.
And there might be other avenues down the road that could be developed to help offset some of the oil we consume. And we're not there yet. And we won't be there for another 15, 20, 30 years. So,
right.
It's a frustrating time, but yeah, I wish I could have a better answer than
fair enough. No, that I makes me feel like I'm not all wet because I, you know, it seems to me that this, what's frustrating about this to me is that this is a choice that has been made. You know, there are certain things that cause prices to go up that are out of your control. You can have natural disasters. You can have a refinery blow up. I mean, there's a million and one things. This is a choice. And that really bothers me.
And I agree with that. It's, this was a self-inflicted wound.
Precisely.
On the American people. And it could have been avoided. I mean, things would have gone up with the war in Ukraine. But it wouldn't have been as nearly as severe as we're at now. So,
and that's one that, you know, it's explicable and it's temporary. I mean, presumably, I mean, the war is going to end at some point. So you can say, all right, you know, I'll weather it. But now, I mean, we're looking at several more years in my mind, honestly, until there's a new administration. So
yeah, I we'll think see. You're probably correct on that.
Yeah. Okay. One more question, then I'll let you go. Electric cars. I mean, obviously, the mandates are coming out, or at very least the incentives to really, really push electric cars. How does that affect you guys strategically?
Well, so we installed EV chargers at two stores recently, one in Aurora and actually one in Geneva. So we have chargers in front of the convenience stores at both those locations, two of them.
Okay.
The demand is not there yet. So that's number one.
Right.
We put them in there. We partnered up with Volta. So they kind of bear a lot of the costs on this. So the difficulty that EV has is you don't make any money on it if you're installing a charger.
Right.
You know, like if you put a two-head charger in with site work, cost of the actual charger itself, upgrading your utility service if needed. I mean, you're talking about upwards of $500,000 and you're not going to make any money on it. So right now it's very difficult to say that EV, and also the cost of an EV vehicle is extremely more than a regular vehicle. And when those batteries go bad, those things are extremely expensive. So I think electrical vehicles right now are like 1-2% of the marketplace. If that goes up to 5-7%, there's a real concern that the electrical grids won't even be able to handle it.
Not be able to handle it, yeah.
Because a lot of people charge at night and electrical grids cool down at night and then ramp up during the day. If you're having the electrical grids ramp up during the day and ramp up at night, I mean, that's a concern. Also, too, if the production or the consumption or the EV rate of EV vehicles goes up to like 5-10%, let's say, of the cars out there, the amount of money that local governments make off of fuel is tremendous. It's, you know, 35% of the cost of that fuel, 30-35%, depending on where you're at, is all taxes.
Right.
So if you get somebody that comes in and they start using EV vehicles, there's no tax on EV right now. So that government, that local municipality is going to lose 10% of their tax revenue from fuel.
Yeah.
How are they going to offset that? So right now, even with the higher prices, I think charging your car is very similar to buying a gallon of gas. It might have flipped a little bit, but they're still very similar. If you add taxes on it, charging your car, and the cost is higher, and it just, I don't know the viability of EV. I mean, maybe in the next, in 15, 20 years, maybe there might be a more sufficient way to do it. I don't like the fact that the government's pushing this right now, because we're just not there. I mean, the technology was there and it was affordable, but we're just not there. So
that seems to be the story of all these things, isn't it? You know, people want to make it a reality now. Well, you can't. it's just not there yet. I mean, it's true with all the alternative energy places too, right?
Yeah, they're just not there.
It's not there yet.
And you know, also too, it's, you know, get into a real good discussion on them. They were talking about global cooling back in the 1960s. They switched to global warming back in the 1980s.
Yeah.
They said back in the 1960s, we were going to run out of oil probably like in the next 20 years.
Oil
storage now throughout the world is actually up compared to the 60s and 70s.
Yep.
It's, you know, they've been talking about this for a long time, and I'm pretty sure right now we live in a nicer, cleaner, healthier world than we did back in the 1960s and 70s, because technology changes, technologies upgrade, they help assist with any CO2 or any other emissions that are occurring.
The doomsayers are always wrong. They are perpetually wrong on lots of these subjects.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a difficult thing. I just don't think we're there yet. I think we probably won't be there for a long time.